times. Americans are good at making things, and one of the things we make lots of is trash. In fact, each of us throws out the equivalent of 7.1 pounds of stuff every day, much of it hauled off to landfills. We toss out so much trash that it's our number one export, and a lot of it ends up in China. Edward Humes writes about all of this and much more in his new book called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. He writes about the high cost of our throwaway society and what we can learn from other countries. Humes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, and he joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And Edward Humes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with those 7 pounds of trash that we throw out every day. What's in it?
Oh, yeah, you'd be surprised.
That's why I ask. You know, go ahead.
I tell people if only we could see a year's worth of our trash on our front lawn, there'd be 1.3 tons of it. You know, we're so good at rolling it to the curb and making it disappear that we have no idea exactly what we're throwing away.
But I assume it's paper cans, plastic wrappers. Go ahead.
The leading category is containers and packaging, this kind of instant trash. That's 25% of what goes to landfill, stuff we buy and instantly throw away. And it's made out of incredibly durable materials, mostly plastic, that essentially lasts forever.
Now, you say 7.1 pounds. The EPA says it's closer to 4.4. How are you calculating this to come up with a different figure?
Well, the question is how EPA calculates it. It's that data is what they publish, and you're correct. They say 4.4 pounds, but they don't weigh a single piece of trash to come up with that number. They actually have this Byzantine calculation called materials flow, and they talk to manufacturers and find out how much stuff they make and then what the life expectancy of that stuff probably is. And from that, they extrapolate what we must be throwing away every year. Well, that made sense 30, 40 years ago when nobody knew who was dumping what where and there was thousands of illegal dumps and they had to figure out some way to get a handle on our trash. But today, there's fewer landfills, they're highly regulated, and they weigh every pound coming in because that's their business model. They charge by the ton. Mm-hmm. And Columbia University, the Earth Engineering Center there, and a journal called Biocycle, started actually gathering the real-world data. And that's where these numbers come from. And even the EPA admits that those higher numbers are the good ones because when they internally calculate the greenhouse gas footprint of different things like landfills, they use the Columbia University data, not their own.
Interesting. MIT did an interesting study. This was in Seattle where they put little trackers on trash to try to figure out how a cup of coffee or I guess a styrofoam cup, how it traveled across the city. Can you talk a little bit about that experiment?
Oh, yeah. I love that.
It's fascinating.
Trash tracker project. And they have this big display. It looks like NORAD tracking missiles, but they're tracking trash around the country. And they found out that the system, such as it is, although efficient at making things disappear from our view, it's not so efficient in how it moves things around the country. They attached trackers to like a computer printer cartridge. It literally crossed the country twice on its path to a place that could finally recycle it. And you think, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, the big deal is the whole point of recycling is that it conserves energy and resources. But if you're shipping something twice across the country, it accumulates a huge carbon and energy footprint that is worse than not recycling at all. So they found a lot of aberrations in the system like that.
And one that I underlined here, a coffee cup took more than 7 days to traverse the city.
Yes, yeah. And part of that is this system of handing off trash we have at transfer stations and then loading it onto trucks and taking it other places. And, you know, somebody's old sneakers ended up running multiple marathons before they got dumped. And that's one of the hidden costs of our waste. Just dealing with it is wasteful in itself.
Well, there are lots of facts and figures in this book, including, you say, 1/6 of the big trucks in this country are trash trucks.
Yes, that's excluding tractor trailers. It's just these sort of big specialty trucks. But yeah, it's startling that that would be the case. But you know, when you think about it, every neighborhood in America has got them moving through them on a weekly basis. So there's got to be a lot of them.
One of my memories as a kid growing up in Massachusetts was going with my dad to the dump. This was back in the 50s, so I'm dating myself here, but we would put our trash in the back of our station wagon and drive off to the dump. And it was sort of a picturesque place. It had a certain odor to it, and there are always people that were picking through the trash. But that was my memory of the dump and what we did with our trash back in the 50s.
Well, and you know, I grew up in Philadelphia, and in my neighborhood, we actually would put out separate garbage pails with our food waste in it, and it would be collected and taken to pig farms, which was up until the 50s and 60s was one of the things that we did to reduce taking things to the dumps. And we also had people come by and ask for rags and clothes that we were throwing away, and that those materials would be recycled. Now they're going to landfills. So some things we're doing better, but other things we've really forgotten a more thrifty, less wasteful way of life, it seems.
And how much of our trash is hauled off to landfills?
Well, the real world data, as opposed
to
the EPA data, is 69% of what we throw away is going to landfills. And we're only recycling about a quarter of our trash. Officially, they say 34%, but it's really 24 point something percent, which is where we were supposed to be over 10 years ago. And then if you look at some of the things that are going to landfills, like I was just looking at this list, you know, 1 out of 100 pounds of our trash is junk mail.
I noticed that.
And that's all recyclable, and yet it's going to landfills. 1 out of 100 pounds going to landfills is junk mail. That's crazy.
Your book begins with a description of a landfill outside of L.A. called Puente Hills.
Yes, yes, the sanitary landfill.
Can you describe that for our listeners?
It is a garbage mountain. It is the largest active landfill in the country, and it contains about 130 million tons of trash. And it is a literal mountain or plateau, really. I mean, you could fit the entire sports complex that contains where the Phillies and the Eagles play on top of this plateau that used to be a valley. It was a dairy farm. It was filled with cows, surrounded by three peaks, one of which was so high it was the Nike missile installation that defended L.A. from attack during the Cold War. And the trash has come up to join those three peaks together into this vast landscape.
And how long has that taken?
Well, it was a little tiny dump in the 1950s in a corner of this dairy farm, and since, you know, it became the go-to place for much of the trash in L.A. outside the city limits, the L.A. County, all the towns that surround L.A., it's grown exponentially since the 80s to this mega structure that we have now. And it's, if you want to stand atop 500 feet of trash and be eye level with the highest buildings in Los Angeles, which you can see from this windswept peak, that's the place to be. You can really have a trash revelation up there. At least I did.
Well, I was going to say, sounds like you did that.
I did. And you know, the environment is this sort of bizarre carnival-like environment. You have all these trucks coming in and dumping things. And it's not just obvious trash, but it's loads of food that maybe has expired but looks perfectly good, and beds and mattresses and couches and grandmom's sewing kit because grandmom died and nobody wants it anymore and her treasure is now trash. And all this stuff you can watch coming in, and then there's all the equipment moving it around. There's the smell, which, as you pointed out, is can be pretty ripe. And there's seagulls flocking everywhere trying to steal the garbage, and they drop it on neighborhoods. So there's an entire team to try and chase the seagulls. They fly drone planes at them. They set off firecrackers. So there's this, like, whole thing going on around it. It's sheer madness.
That's what we do with our stuff.
Amazing. That's what we have to do when you make this much trash.
Well, and the other part of what you write about is how much trash then gets exported. And in fact, you say it's our number one export, and a lot of that stuff ending up in China. I guess not surprisingly, but China.
Well, one of the things I tried to do with this book is find characters and narratives to tell this, you know, and there's the woman, the queen of trash, Zhang Yin, who, you know, started out collecting scrap paper in the Los Angeles area as a business. She'd immigrated and needed to make some money, and it grew and grew because we were throwing away so much stuff that we saw no value in, and China needed. They were ramping up their manufacturing base. They needed paper to make cardboard and to package stuff to sell back to us, and she started exporting it. And now she is, in terms of the number of cargo containers going out of our ports, the biggest exporter in the U.S., and she has the biggest papermaking plant in China says she became their first female billionaire with our trash.
Well, which gets me to a chapter about David Steiner. He's the CEO of Waste Management, as you just say, the world's largest trash company. And you quote him as saying, and I'm quoting him, someday we may pay customers for their trash rather than the other way around. We're not there yet, but it could happen. A few years ago, you'd never hear me say that. Do we need a kind of rethinking of our trash instead of something that we throw away, but think of it as something of value?
Exactly. Well, a couple of years ago, he hired a consultant to try and help his company be more sustainable, and they suggested you needed to change the name of your company from Waste Management to Materials Management. And he just kind of laughed and said, "You got to be kidding." And then a few years later, he's saying, "You know what? Maybe they were right, because I have $10 billion worth of stuff locked away in my landfills. If I could recapture that value and make things out of it, make energy out of it, whatever, that's what it's really worth. And it's crazy that I'm just burying this stuff. And so, yeah, there could be a day when I start paying to get this and making money by doing that." And that is a big transition in thinking, because this idea that the word waste is just synonymous with trash, something that has no value and that we just need to get rid of, is a perversion of the true meaning of the word, which is the physical manifestation of our wastefulness, that we're squandering things that do have value. And we are unique in that regard compared to past civilizations in terms of our willingness to waste stuff that has value.
Well, in fact, you seem to be a big fan of these trash-to-energy plants. Europe has a lot of them. Germany actually has no landfills, according to your book, and they rely on these trash-to-energy plants. I know there's some here in the United States. Do you see that as solving several problems? One is looking at our trash as a form of energy?
Well, it's better than what we're doing. It's not an ideal solution. It's terribly inefficient, actually, to sort of make overly wasteful products and then try and reclaim some of that by making energy out of it. The real solution is to find ways to be less wasteful in the first place. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the science on it, these new state-of-the-art plants, when they're managed well, unlike, you know, Harrisburg's had a bad experience,
yes,
but that's
say.
A fault of the financing, not of the technology. The modern plants that they're building in Europe are smaller. They're kind of community-based and a source of community pride. I mean, Denmark has one that's tucked inside a community ski park. It's really cool. And the modern plants have lower dioxin emissions, the main toxic component from trash incineration, than your average backyard barbecue. I mean, mm-hmm. So they've solved that problem. And the carbon footprint of these modern plants, the greenhouse gas footprint, rather, is lower than landfills, which emit a lot of methane. So you actually are solving some environmental problems, not creating more when you go this route.
And that's Edward Humes, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, author of a new book called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. We're going to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. Sunday, April 29th, I'll host a Madame Butterfly dinner. Miss Butter, formerly of New York City Opera, will perform selections from Puccini's masterpiece and traditional Japanese numbers. Margaret Kuo, support WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're about halfway through the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. At least we hope so. We will make our goal and reach it on time if you do your part and become a member, a supporter of WHYY. Think of all the programs and services that you enjoy. News and information around the clock on the radio, events here at WHYY, and engaging and involving social media at WHYY.org. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We produce almost 500 live, hour-long interviews every year on Radio Times. It's a handmade show that the producers and I put together every day. We keep you informed about local, national, and international news, provide commentary and analysis, and introduce you to interesting people and ideas. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks for that pledge.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with organically tanned leather from Scotland, Prussian burl wood, French seams, and curve control. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Edward Humes about trash. That's the subject of his new book called Garbology, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about all the stuff that we throw out, where it goes, and how we could rethink our trash. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You were saying earlier that, what, about 25% of our stuff is recycled? I guess my question is, how much of a dent, I guess, has recycling made in all the trash that we toss?
Well, it certainly reduced some of the material that we're landfilling, and that's good, and we're able to put those resources back and close the loop on them. But most of the recyclables that we produce are still going to landfills. They're not being recycled. So we're not really good at it yet.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, many cities and townships have, you know, recycling pickup on the curb. Why do you think people don't recycle as much as they could or probably should?
Sometimes it's just not easy to do. I mean, you know, and I've run into this. Oh, I've got an old computer. Where do I take it? What do I do with it? You know, what do I do with my household batteries when my, you know, radio or my son's toy runs out? A lot of people don't have this information accessible and or don't know where to find it. And other communities haven't really put the emphasis on recycling. I mean, some towns have been standouts, like San Francisco has been really good, and Portland and Seattle have very high recycling rates, but they are outside the mainstream.
We were talking about landfills, and I know one of the problems of landfills is methane gas. Is that the number one problem in terms of the environment?
Well, it's certainly one factor. I mean, when you have a big mountain of garbage,
well, that's true.
And is material putrefying inside, it produces a lot of methane, and that is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, that the product of combustion. So those emissions are very much a source of concern for the impact they can have on the climate. And that's why the EPA looked at that and said, oh, we never expected to find this, but the you know, burning trash actually is better than landfilling it in terms of greenhouse gas footprint.
Wow. That tells you a lot. There are also these, you know, escapees from landfill that end up, and there's a big mountain of them or pile of them scattered across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, the trash that gets away.
Yes.
And plastic ocean pollution, and we can see it on any beach you walk on. You'll see, look at those pretty bits of color in the sand, and it turns out, though, those aren't shells. That's plastic. I challenge any listener to go out and walk a beach somewhere, an ocean beach, and not find plastic in the sand washed up, because it has become omnipresent. And I'm sure many people have heard of the Pacific garbage patch and these gyres of trash. And we've been a little misled on that, as if there's like a floating landfill of big pieces of trash out there. And that's not really the problem. Although there are, you know, there is that kind of debris. If only that was the only problem, it would be, you know, doable to clean
up
some
of
it. But there's plastic doesn't decompose the way organic matter does, but it does break up into smaller particles from wave action in the sun. It becomes brittle. And the real issue is these plastic particles that are the size of plankton that fish that are at the bottom of the food chain eat. And these plastic particles also become magnets for toxic chemicals that find their way in the ocean that aren't really water soluble, so they're always looking for something to cling to, and then you have this double issue of the food chain absorbing plastic that may be toxic, contaminated, and scientists are still trying to figure out just how bad that is. But I can tell you this: if you want to understand how much plastic pollution is entering the oceans every year, think of losing 40 giant Nimitz-class super aircraft carriers at sea a year.
Wow. Wow.
The biggest ships ever built. That's what's getting lost every year in terms of the weight of plastic in the ocean.
One of the saddest photos I've seen recently is of a young bird. Their stomach literally filled with bottle caps. They starved to death because there was no room for the food. And this was a little baby bird. I think someone had done an autopsy. And there, just to reinforce the point you just made, there were all these bottle caps and bits of plastic in their stomach.
Yeah, I've seen those pictures too, and marine mammals, whales and so forth have washed up on shore, and their digestive tracts will be filled with plastic that they have eaten along with their true food, and they end up starving to death. And this crew from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography caught these little fish called lantern fish. They did this long trawl through the Pacific garbage patch. When they dissected these lantern fish, which makes up a huge percentage of the biomass in the oceans, this little fish that so many other creatures feed on, and they in turn feed on plankton, but they were eating all these particles of plastic. 10% of them had plastic in their guts.
Wow.
And then if those are toxic, it becomes concentrated as bigger fish eat many of these lantern fish, and then bigger fish eat those fish. It works it up to the fish that we eat, and it could be concentrating a lot of nasties in our food supply. The scientists don't know yet. They're trying to figure it out.
So what should we do about all this?
What should we do? Well, the people I talk to were working on this project who are active in thinking and doing things about waste talk a lot about changing our habits. And for at the consumer level, for individuals, that can begin small. Maybe I don't need to use 500 disposable grocery bags a year. I could bring a couple of reusable bags to the market and sort of cut off what one fellow I talked to calls the gateway drug of waste. That's how he sees plastic bags. If you can cut off that little addiction, then you can really start making progress. And maybe you look at your bottled water that you're paying more for than gasoline per ounce and say, I have a great municipal water supply. I can use my own water and put it in my own bottle. And there's all sorts of things you can do that are very simple that save you money and also are very effective at cutting your waste production down, because we're oblivious to it mostly, but a little thought changes those habits.
And that's Edward Humes, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the 7.1 pounds of trash that we throw out every day, where it goes and its implications, its various costs. And he's the author of a new book called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And there's much more to talk about. I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. We've covered a fair amount of territory. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Terry from Upper Black Eddy to join our conversation. Terry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. This is a very interesting conversation.
Thanks.
I've been a garbage picker for like 10 years. I have furnished 3 homes out of nothing but stuff that I find along the roadside. And I'd love, Edward, if you can speak to this observation. Over the years, I have noticed that in the lower economic neighborhoods, I find the stuff. If I need a kitchen set, a dresser, a bunk bed, that's where I go, the lower economic neighborhoods. In the well-heeled neighborhoods, there's nothing there. And I can only imagine it's because the lower economic environments, they don't somehow understand the value of something, or they don't own the screwdriver to replace the loose bolts. But this has been a conservation over the years. Is there any research regarding what different socioeconomic levels throw away?
Well, Terry, thanks for the call. Have you looked at that, Edward?
Actually, there's a fellow who kind of founded this analog of archaeology called garbology, Bill Rathje, who did look at that and actually found that the trash profiles of different economic classes are surprisingly similar. What you tend to see, higher concentration of yard and garden product waste at the higher levels, because apparently there's more resources devoted to lawn care. But other than that, it seems to be remarkably similar. So I'm sure our caller has had that anecdotal experience, but you know, over large populations, that doesn't seem to be the case. And I've certainly, my experience is that everyone is wasteful. You know, I love what our caller said about finding things of value, though, that have been discarded. That is really... There's an entire program in San Francisco called an Artist in Residence at the Dump program, an Art at the Dump. And they, at all times, there's two artists who compete to get these coveted slots. And their job is to make art and to use tools to make their art. It all come from the dump. And the things they find are astonishing and not at all what we think of as trash, but that's what gets thrown away. You know, there's a... One artist makes embroidered and soft sewn sculptures. And she said, how am I going to do this? I need my sewing materials. And they told her, you know what, just wait. It will come. If you need it, it will come. And within a week, these two amazing sewing kits, complete, showed up that she could use. And it had just been cast aside, no doubt, because, you know, somebody died and their treasure became trash.
Terry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You quote some findings from the Garbage Project, and Terry's call reminded me of one of their findings. Families in low-income neighborhoods tended to buy the smallest size packages of food, while trash from the affluent neighborhoods was rife with large and economy-sized products. Can you explain why that is? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it's very sensible because a family that's living paycheck to paycheck has to think in the short term, how can I get through the next week or so, and not be able to afford the larger bulk purchases, which actually turn out to be, over the long haul, more economical and less wasteful because it's, you know, less packaging. Mm-hmm. That's buying in bulk, buying large. Buying a gallon of shampoo instead of a 6-ounce bottle is actually a great strategy for waste reduction if you can do it. And in the long term, it saves money.
Discarded birth control pill dispensers showed that a substantial minority of women were taking the pills incorrectly, missing and skipping days. I guess this is what an anthropologist can figure out as they paw through our trash.
Exactly. The cultural consequences of our ways do reveal a lot of things about us. One of the most fascinating things is how much we underestimate certain kinds of waste. Universally across the board, people would say they used a lot less alcoholic products than their trash showed. And that they ate a lot more healthy food than they actually did. So, and maybe that's just to be expected. But it really points to the fact... Actually, the neat part about that is people could predictably, quite accurately estimate how much alcohol their neighbors were consuming.
Well, of course, and then, that sounds like human beings.
But that blindness is really infects everything about our waste because people say, there's no way I make 7 pounds of trash a day. And that is an average, of course, and some people don't. But mostly we're underestimating just how wasteful we are.
Another thing that you quote from the Garbage Project, issued a mild warning to romantics to rethink how they celebrate February 14th. While almost no Halloween candy is ever thrown in the trash, only wrappers, a great deal of Valentine's Day candy never leaves the wrapper or the box and ends up in the dump instead.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I think that speaks for itself about that. I like it, though.
Yeah, me too. Let me get Gloria from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Gloria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was impressed by the incentives in Germany to get people to recycle. First of all, it's required, and they have like 5 different kinds of recycling in different containers, including food that goes to the farm. And secondly, you pay according to how much trash is picked up from your house. So that's a great incentive for people to recycle.
Well, I appreciate the call, Gloria, and that's something that you say in your book, Edward.
Yeah, well, there are communities in the U.S. who are turning to that model. So the smaller your trash can for weekly pickup, the less you pay. So, I mean, that's a great incentive, and it makes perfect sense. If you make less waste, you should pay less rather than subsidize somebody else's very wasteful habits by paying the same amount. So that's a kind of use of market incentives to encourage less wastefulness that has been very effective. And it's interesting, too, that they are so much more effective at recycling than we are. Most other countries are, frankly.
But in this country, I know a lot of businesses pay for their trash, and the more trash they create, the more they pay. So we have that incentive, don't we, in this country?
Yeah, businesses certainly do. It seems like it hasn't been enough, at least until fairly recent times, to get people thinking and get businesses thinking about being less wasteful and how not only to turn it from into less of a cost, but is it possible to turn that into a source of revenue? Some businesses are actually doing that now and really reducing their waste and instead composting. And then, you know, Walmart sells its food waste as compost from its food operations and actually makes money from their trash now. So that's a pretty exciting rethinking of what we think of as waste.
Is there something we can learn from Europe about all the packaging that comes with the stuff that we buy?
Yeah, well, they have a lot less of it because their model imposes sort of responsibility for waste-generating products on the producers of the products. It's more of a shared responsibility than just expecting consumers and taxpayers to deal with it. In the U.S., you know, we kind of give a free ride. If my tiny little, razor comes in an enormous package and bubble wrap and plastic and paper, I'd have to deal with that waste. Mm-hmm. And my waste company that serves my neighborhood has to deal with that waste, and the manufacturer has no penalty at all. No, you know, it's an external cost to them.
Do you?
And some countries and some communities are saying, well, you know what? I think we need to share the pain. And if once you do that, then suddenly those packages magically begin to shrink.
So, how much have you changed how you use things, what you throw away, what you recycle, what you do and don't buy?
Well, that's something where, you know, my family is working on. In part we had already started. In part, some of the things I've learned on this journey writing about trash has helped it along. But we compost our food waste. We don't put any of that in our trash because we have a vegetable garden, which is also a great environmental strategy. Plus, you get tasty stuff growing in your backyard. And tried to cut down on the containerized materials, like, you know, we don't buy bottled water anymore. We all have reusable cups and put our coffee in. And so it's little things, but over time they do add up. And that, you know, if you look at what's possible to do about some of our big environmental problems, trash is one of the, you know, ones that we can actually, without a pack and a big corporation behind you or a lot of resources, do something about. And then it turns out, if you look at families that get serious about it, they save a lot of money. They go on more vacations. They have college funds that they can afford that they couldn't before.
We're almost up on a break here, but does your family actually buy less as a result of some of your research? Or you think differently about your purchases?
I think we think differently about it. And if you look at something and say, this is going to be trash in 6 months or a year, then the next question is, do I really need this? You know, can I buy a refurbished computer if I need a new computer and repurpose something that already exists and getting something new? And it turns out a lot of manufacturers are happy to sell you those refurbished and they'll give you the same warranty you would have gotten for a new one. So what's the – why not? It's a win-win all around. So, yeah, I mean, thinking about those kinds of things that you didn't before – That's the path to less waste.
And that's Edward Humes, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about trash, the subject of his new book called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break, and after that short break, we'll get some more callers in on the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. On now at AS1812 Productions, Boston Marriage, the celebrated comedy by renowned American playwright David Mamet. Boston Marriage stars Grace Gunglewski and Suzanne O'Donnell as a most unconventional couple in this comedy full of sharp barbs, intense loyalty, and more than a little scandal. Boston Marriage runs through May 20th only. Tickets and info at www.1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're about halfway through the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. At least we hope so. We will make our goal and reach it on time if you do your part and become a member, a supporter of WHYY. Think of all the programs and services that you enjoy. News and information around the clock on the radio, events here at WHYY, and engaging and involving social media at WHYY.org. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We produce almost 500 live, hour-long interviews every year on Radio Times. It's a handmade show that the producers and I put together every day. We keep you informed about local, national, and international news, provide commentary and analysis, and introduce you to interesting people and ideas. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks for that pledge. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking about trash with Edward Humes, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Nancy from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Nancy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Love the show.
Thanks.
I'm lucky enough to be able to spend about half of the year out in the Canadian Rockies, and my little town has a very high level of awareness about recycling. And one of the things that they do is they have kind of a tractor-trailer type thing that they move around to each neighborhood. So it's in each neighborhood one day a week. And at this, you go to this big trailer, and they have individual bins for glass, for metal cans, for household plastic, for cardboard, newsprint, and mixed paper. So, you know, in my neighborhood, Monday is recycling day, and so it's just part of the routine. And so I think people can be retrained to be more conscious of their trash.
Well, Nancy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Edward, do you agree with her?
Yeah, well, I'd be curious to see if Nancy's community feels like this is a hardship, or if it's more of a community spirit kind of thing. What's the psychology of having to do all that separating?
Are people enthusiastic about it, Nancy?
Oh yeah, it's just a part of the life. I mean, this is a mountain community in a pristine environment, so a lot of people are very aware of the need to preserve this pristine environment. And so, yeah, I mean, people just take it for granted. It's not a hardship. In fact, there's a three-day music festival during the summer, and they get about 5,000 people a day from outside the community. And the goal of the festival is no landfill, no trash to the landfill. So there are volunteers stationed all around, and, somebody walks by with an empty plastic bottle, and they point you to where the recycling can for that empty plastic bottle is.
Oh, interesting. Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Sounds like a nice
Thank
place
you,
to live.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, with offices going or trying to go or allegedly going paperless, I don't think they've been particularly successful if you look at how I use paper. but certainly newspapers are getting thinner. People are using the internet more to get their news. I don't know if people still get phone books anymore. Do you think that's having at least some kind of an impact, the fact that the country is less reliant on paper, e-books, things like that, that will affect the kind of an amount of trash we throw out?
It has. Newsprint definitely was a much bigger a part of the waste stream than it is now. That's changing, and the electronic versions of our documents is a big factor in that. But then again, you know, the phone books are still landing at our houses that nobody wants, and you know, the waste that's embedded in our daily lives has become almost invisible. And, I mentioned junk mail before. You know, it was like 85 billion pieces of junk mail generated last year. Mm-hmm. It's over half our mail. And I say it's embedded. It's almost a trash addiction, because we have a system where taxpayers are subsidizing the junk mail that they really, I don't think, want.
Not in my house.
and yet we're paying extra for the right to receive this. It's crazy. And more than half of it never gets recycled. It gets sent to landfills where it just rots. And that kind of waste is embedded all over our houses. Our electronics are incredibly wasteful. If we could get rid of the the drain on the power system that our devices cause when they're turned off, these vampire electronics that you think are off, like your cable box and other things that actually never really power down. It's the equivalent energy nationwide of 20 coal-fired power plants being wasted. I mean, think about that. And we're paying for that on our electric bill as well. Why do we accept that? I can only imagine it's because people don't really understand just how much waste is being foisted on them and forced on them. But those sorts of things need to be rethought if we really desire to be less wasteful.
You had mentioned batteries, and I, you know, to be honest with you, I have a gigantic box of batteries. I don't know what to do with them. Do you know what to do with batteries?
Well, it varies state to state, but in most places you're not supposed to put it in the regular trash, nor are you supposed to put it in the regular recycling bins if you have them. Your local agency or private trash hauler is supposed to have specific information available on how you can correctly dispose of things like that and old cell phones. But got a drawer full of old cell phones and chargers that you don't need anymore. You know, there are supposedly, in every community, proper disposal methods for those types of specialized trash, but most people don't know them.
Yeah. Let me get Joe from New Jersey to join our conversation. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yes. Well, I manage a trash company in Maryland, and I run a sales team that essentially goes door-to-door in individual residential areas where it's competition for trash pickup for companies for a better price. So I'm curious to find out if you think one day if we actually get paid to throw away our trash, if it will be regulated at one price that we get paid per pound or whatnot, or if it will be based on competition with private companies.
And Joe, we touched on that earlier, but it's an interesting way to put the question at whether there would be competition for our trash or just sort of a system weighing it and paying us.
I think it's wide open, but if you look at what goes on with recycled goods now, I think it's a kind of open market at this point. You know, except for the obviously the states that have imposed a bottle deposit, in which case obviously it's a set fee and you can return your Gatorade bottles and your soda bottles and so forth and get your money back. Most people don't do that, though. They just throw it in the recycling bin. Somebody else gets that money. You know, my son's very entrepreneurial. He makes sure that the recycling gets, if he takes it, he gets to pocket the money. So,
well, good for him. Yeah. I mean, I remember as a kid doing that as well. Let me get, looks like Gail from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Gail, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can
there.
You hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm an urban forager, I call it, and I've gotten food. I've redone my wardrobe with designer clothes. The last great thing I found was a working iPod. I wanted to say, in contrast to what the other caller said about neighborhoods being a factor and socioeconomic status, I find the best stuff in the ritzier neighborhoods, but mostly in the ritzier neighborhoods where a lot of them don't have cars to take the stuff to recycling or to a thrift store or a consignment shop. They get lazy and they don't want to haul it or they don't have time to schlep it to the store, and they just throw it out. If it's in a neighborhood where they have cars, like Old City, a lot of the rich people have garages and cars, you know, they'll take it. But if they don't, then
it's on the street.
It's up for grabs.
Well, Gail, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Another point of view. Seems like we've touched into the foragers and trash pickers in our audience, Edward.
Yeah, well, the original, you know, 100 years ago, the trash collection companies used to be called scavenger services. And there's a, you know, a rich history of scavenging or foraging for valuables in what other people throw away. And, you know, if you the stuff that comes in at a landfill, if you stand and watch it, you see couches and mattresses and whole truckloads of food that appears to be entirely edible that, you know, for one reason or another gets disposed of at landfills. And, you know, I saw a truckload of jacuzzis, and it's just crazy stuff. Things that clearly, you know, paint, huge amounts of paint, unopened cans or partially used cans show up at landfills. And, yeah, just some places will try and segregate that material and give it away or donate it to charity. And there is a whole little subculture of people who go to the landfills that do that, collection points that do that, and get things they need for home repairs and all sorts of other things.
I mean, it is a kind of out of sight, out of mind mentality, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is. It's a magic trick that isn't really very magic because, yeah, we roll it to the curb. That's how we can be unaware that we're making, 102 tons of trash in our lifetime, because we send it out in little bits in these wonderful companies like our previous caller. They're very good at hauling it away and poof, mischief managed, as the Harry Potter books say. But it's nothing magical about creating mountains out of trash and squandering immense amounts of resources, because the original post-war economy was based on we'll never run out of stuff, where we have this endless abundance. And so who cares if we waste things? It's just evidence of our prosperity. But we've now seen that there is not unlimited abundance, and therefore unlimited waste is a very bad strategy.
I wonder, too, whether the United States is different from Europe and they seem to handle their trash differently, because relatively speaking, we have a lot of land and the potential for a lot of cheap land, which I would assume makes landfill profitable.
Well, that's the thing. It's not like we're running out of room to bury our trash if that's the choice we want to make. I mean, and America is blessed with huge amounts of open space that other countries don't have. And so that has helped move them away from landfill. But even so, very consumer-oriented cultures like Japan, for instance, with its great economy, great in terms of large economy, they only generate 2.5 pounds of trash per person. And I just find it fascinating that there's such disparities between America and other highly developed, prosperous countries. I think it's because we don't see it and don't think about it the way other societies do. We almost think it's our right to be wasteful.
Is there a city or a community in the U.S. you think that does a better job than the rest of us?
There's a lot of communities that are doing great jobs. There's a regional breakdown, and if you look at that, you see that the New England states are particularly good at not landfilling. And, they only send 31% of their trash to landfills, and they make energy out of more than that, and then the rest is recycled. The Mid-Atlantic is still below the average. About 59% goes to landfills. But then you look at the Rocky Mountain areas, the big space countries, 88% of their trash goes to landfills. So you see a pattern that kind of makes sense. The more space you have, the more you're willing to just dig a hole in the ground and throw your trash into it. I guess it makes sense. But it's not a great economic strategy. Even if the land is cheap, the cost to the environment and the squandering of valuable materials is still a bad economic and environmental practice.
And that's Edward Humes, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Frank from Palmyra, New Jersey to join us. And Frank, go ahead. You're on the air. And that would be number one. Yes, go ahead, Frank.
I wonder if you would examine a supposition of mine. I live directly on the Delaware River, so I see all the litter, the plastic, etc. And my idea is that local towns, their stormwater drains go empty right into the river. So when there's a gully washer, all the litter goes into the river, goes into the bay, goes into the ocean.
Is that true, Edward Humes?
That is exactly correct. That is a major source of the plastic and other pollutants that find their way into both river and marine environments. Yeah, your observation is right on the money. It's not the only source, but it's a huge one.
Sorry about that, Frank. But I'm assuming when you have storms, and we've had some big ones over the last couple of years, that just sort of swooshes all this stuff into rivers and then streams rivers and then into the ocean.
It does. And some communities actually are taking steps to try and corral some of that debris that comes at Los Angeles has been working on that. Because I happen to live in a community now in California that is right, right on the edge of one of these sort of artificial rivers that all this debris sweeps down into the ocean after rainstorms, and they have started to try and head that off at the pass and catch some of at least larger pieces of debris before it gets into the ocean, and that those kinds of efforts can have a big impact on reducing the flow of debris into our marine environments.
Well, let me squeeze one more caller on. Robert from Elmer, New Jersey, joins us. And Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. I didn't catch the entire show, but I called in because I caught a bit of it about trash. And well, my comment is on trash removal.
Go ahead.
Put it out to the curb and the garbage truck comes, and out in the rural parts of South Jersey.
Robert, just a quick favor, only because we're almost out of time, and I see, according to my computer, it says here, Roosevelt Land Pneumatic Tube System. Can you talk about that?
Well, in New York City, Roosevelt Island, the public trash cans there have a pneumatic tube system below ground that moves the trash, kind of like that last mile solution. In this case, of course, the last mile is the point of origination where you fill the trash can. And this automated system moves the trash to a central collection facility. Saves a lot of fuel, the garbage trucks and stuff like that.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Using a pneumatic system. Go ahead, Edward Humes.
It's the subway of trash, basically. and it's a really cool solution, but it required actually building that into this community on Roosevelt Island, the way you would lay a subway train.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
It's a big infrastructure commitment to have that kind of waste removal. But once you have it, it reduces the fossil fuel spewing trash trucks that and all the energy you have to use to collect the trash that way. So it's a very novel but intriguing trash solution.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Edward Humes, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Marty, it was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. The book is called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. Edward Humes is the author of a number of books and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.